So we're looking at the Dharma through symbols and stories. And we've been using, for a little while, we've been using as a framework, we've been using this system of meditation of Sangharakshas, or system of spiritual development. It can be extended into a system of spiritual development, which is integration, positive emotion, spiritual death, and spiritual rebirth. So we've seen over the last few weeks that, first of all, on integration, how we need to sort of bring the different bundles, the different parts of ourselves together to become sort of whole human being, rather than a bundle of conflicting drives. To do that, we sort of need to have something serious enough, important enough in our life to unify us, that we're something that we're really about, which unifies us, which creates a being out of all, that creates a unified being out of all these sort of bundles. And this is partly a matter of becoming sort of aware of our unconscious drives, and volitions through meditation and through ethical practice. And we've seen that also developing positive emotion is just a completely crucial part of the spiritual life. Insight, enlightenment, is as much about transforming the emotions as it is about anything to do with how we see clearly. We see through the lenses of our emotions. We see the world through the lenses of our emotions. And until our emotions are positive, we don't see the world as it is. We see the world as distorted by our own mental states. A negative emotion just sort of traps us in our own ego. It cuts us off from our connectedness to others and to the world. So we've seen that. We've spent a few weeks looking at positive emotion. And now we've been looking, for the last couple of weeks, few weeks, we've been looking at spiritual rebirth. Sorry, spiritual death. Looking at spiritual death. So we've looked at how the Dharma is all about growing, transcending our present version of ourselves, and that we can't do that unless we're willing to leave the old version behind, our present self behind. In a sense, we can't do it unless we're willing to die to what we are now and step out into the unknown. So we looked at the symbol of the Dakini. This one week we looked at the symbol of the Dakini, the sky dancer in the sort of northern Indian Tibetan tradition, and how that represents the joy, if you like, of leaving a sort of safe, comfortable, but rather stuck self behind and moving out into a state of freedom, exhilarating freedom, much riskier, but also much more exhilarating. And we looked, we also looked at the Buddha's going forth from his luxurious home life as a into the life of a homeless wanderer. As an example of spiritual death, the death of an old self, if you like, the death of the self who lived a luxurious life in a palace as a prince, leaving one way of life behind, stepping out into something completely new and risky and challenging in order to bring something else into existence, to bring something new into existence. And we also saw that the Buddha did that. In fact, he didn't just do it once. We normally talk about the going forth of the Buddha as when he left home and went into the homeless life, but he actually did it over and over again. He went forth from two different styles of meditation teaching, where he could have been the leader of a school. He went forth from being a very well-respected ascetic. He went forth over and over again because he saw that those were traps. They were traps that were going to sort of get him stuck in a dead end. And as a result, he reaped the ultimate reward, the ultimate freedom, which was he became enlightened. So today I'd like to follow up on that theme a bit. Follow up on that theme of sort of continually, need to continually go forth, to continually step out of our old version of ourselves. So I mean, practicing the Dharma is about continually growing. Which means continually going beyond our old patterns, our old self, our old habits, our old view of ourselves. If you like, it means continually dying, or the person we have become continually dying, as well as continually being reborn in a more universal, a larger, a freer form. So We're going to look at this over the next couple of weeks. We're going to look at this in 2 days, in two ways. Vajratara and I, when we were discussing this, we talked about spiritual death. We came up with the idea of looking at stories in the Buddhist tradition. And one lot seemed to be about stories of spiritual death and bad guys. And the other one was spiritual death and stuck people. Okay? So we're going to look at spiritual death and bad guys next week, and spiritual death and stuck people this week. So, about moving on from a self. And the ones next week will be about moving on from a definitely unskillful self, leaving an unskillful self behind. And this week we're going to look at something that's maybe for a lot of us a little bit closer to home, which is moving on from a self which is fine as far as it goes. Nothing particularly wrong with it. It's not fundamentally unskillful. It might even be admirable. It's good, but it's not good enough. It's good, but it's keeping us, in a sense, stuck. It's good, but it's become a bit stagnant. The good can be the enemy of the better. So we're going to look at that for a bit. So what this is about is it's about how to avoid a common pitfall or a common trap in the spiritual life, which might not apply to you. Actually, it might not apply to you now. But if you carry on practicing the Dharma, it will apply eventually. It will definitely apply. So what is this trap? What is this trap, this pitfall? Could put it in several different ways. One way of putting it could be in terms of settling down. So Dharma practice, as I've said, is about going beyond ourselves, transcending ourselves, which isn't particularly cozy or comfortable. But we can use the Dharma to make life more cozy and comfortable for ourselves. To stop going beyond ourselves, we can use it as a way of settling into a cozy way of life, which sort of looks like Dharma practice. We might think it's Dharma practice, but it's not Dharma practice. So maybe we've been practicing for a while, and maybe we've largely got out of some of the negative or uncomfortable mental states that used to plague us a bit. And maybe we enjoy life a lot more. Maybe we can appreciate things more. We appreciate going out to nature more. We appreciate the simple things more. We get pleasure. We get pleasure from meditating. It's a nice little holiday, pleasant holiday from our usual states of mind. We've dropped some of the habits that used to sort of create a bit of grit and unhappiness for us. We got lots of nice friends, really pleasant and harmonious. Our practice is pleasant and we enjoy it. Nothing wrong with any of that. It's great. But part of us now says, this is great. We've sort of got out of the grit that got us practicing the Dharma. It's very pleasant. Let's go to sleep. Let's doze. What a relief. Let's have a doze. But the Dharma isn't about dozing. It's about awakening. It's about awakening. It's not about creating a pleasant nest for ourselves, a more pleasant cocoon, rather than the sort of slightly more smelly one we used to live in before we started practicing. It's about emerging from our cocoon altogether, becoming a butterfly, if you like, to carry the analogy further, which might not, from the point of view of the caterpillar, might not seem a particularly cozy thing to do. It might seem altogether more cozy to stay in our cocoon. So doing that's not always easy or cozy. And if in a way, this sort of dead end in practicing the Dharma, turning the Dharma into just another way of leading a very pleasant, cozy life, comes about because we've forgotten that the Dharma is meant to be challenging and invigorating. We've turned it into another way of getting some pleasure, some comfort, some security. So that's one way. Another way we can get into that sort of dead end is to start using the Dharma as a bolster for our ego. We can make a respectable career out of being a Dharma practitioner or a Dharma teacher. What we've done is we've joined the Church of England School of Buddhism, basically. I'm a Buddhist vicar. I'm very respectable. The Dharma is no longer something radical and shocking and electric. It's respectable. It's nice. It's respectable. We are respectable. We all like social status in one form or another, so maybe we can get it by being a Buddhist. The Dharma becomes a way we can get that. Our Dharma practice becomes a badge that our ego wears. Oh, I'm such a good practitioner, I'm so advanced. Maybe we even turn it into a worldly career. We find some way of turning the Dharma into a way of getting status and money in the world. So what these sort of dead ends in a way have all got in common is that there are ways in which the Dharma has stopped being a way we transcend our worldly ego, and they become a way our worldly ego gets what it wants. So the worldly ego has appropriated the Dharma to get what it wants. It's stopped being something that does the worldly ego in, and it's now become something the worldly ego is using to get what it wants. And I mean, one way we could talk about what our ego wants, it's a simplification, obviously. One way we can talk about what our ego wants is in terms of a nice little list called the 8 worldly winds. So these are the ways the ego thinks that it's doing well. If it's doing on this side, it's doing very badly on this side. So it goes after these. It goes for gain, wealth, money, possessions. It goes for praise and approval. Really dislikes it when people dispraise us or blame us. Pleasure and comfort. Likes pleasure and comfort. Doesn't like discomfort. Likes status and fame. Yes, look, I'm big. Doesn't like being a nobody. So these are sort of four, if you like, scorecards which the ego uses to see whether it's doing well in life. It's always wanting to go to these ends. And what's happening here is that instead of using the Dharma as a way to go beyond all of this and be about something different, we can start using the Dharma to get these. We can start using the Dharma to get gain. We can start perhaps trying to sell it for money. Easy to use it to get praise. Pleasure and comfort. It can become quite a pleasant way, a comfortable way of settling down, or it could be about status and fame. So without being aware of it, usually, we can use the Dharma to get one of these rather than going beyond them all. And this is a really well-known trap. It's a really well-known trap in the Buddhist tradition. I didn't just sort of make it up. So the tradition is full of stories about it. So I might actually talk about three different, it might be two, depending on time, stories that sort of illustrate this trap, something about this trap. So the first one I'd like to use is the story of somebody called Tuan Song. So Tuan Song was an 8th century, we introduced him last year, I think, when we were talking about the refuge tree, but he was a 7th century, he was born about 600, 7th century Chinese practitioner who made this completely epic journey to India to find the true Dharma, to bring back the true Dharma, to bring back texts to China, which he spent years doing this. I can't remember exactly, it might have been 16 years going to India and coming back, staying in India. And then he spent the rest of his life translating these texts. And as a result, he completely transformed Chinese Buddhism. Had a huge impact on Chinese Buddhism. And if you look at Tuan Song's life, it seems that in a sense he was almost like meant to do this epic journey. It looks like this was his destiny. It was what he was born for. He had dreams, for example, pushing him in that direction. He had dreams pushing him in that direction. He had visions when he was meditating on retreat pushing him in that direction. He was fascinated by the idea of India from an early age and dissatisfied with the Dharma translations that he got. He didn't think they were right. And without trying to, he just found himself falling into circumstances where he learnt the languages he would need to do this trip and to translate these texts. So he came to know over the course of his life, over the course of the early part of his life, up to perhaps the age of 27, he came to know that this was what he was meant to do. He was meant to go to India and bring the Dharma back to China in a purer form than it was available. So he knew that was what he was meant to do. What he didn't know was whether he wanted to do it. Okay. I mean, this is a terrible journey. This, you know, you don't just sort of go in travel agent and buy a ticket. This is a terrible journey. You can't. It's impossible to imagine anything like this today because there's nowhere that far apart anymore. It's like going to Mars. I mean, the land route goes around the north end of the Himalayas through the Gobi Desert, over the Western Passes, through Afghanistan, Pakistan, India. So it goes through one of the most inhospitable places on Earth, the Gobi Desert. Then it goes over some of the highest mountain passes on Earth, and it goes over some of the greatest rivers on Earth as well. I mean, it's a terrific journey, many, many thousands of miles. It also goes through the territory of several potentially hostile kings, and it goes through serious bandit country, okay? So it's not something to be undertaken lightly. So he sort of knew, he had at the back of his mind, he knew he should be doing this, but he wasn't at all sure he wanted to do it. And in some ways, Xuan Zang wasn't an obvious sort of, he wasn't an obvious explorer. He wasn't a sort of Scott or a Shackleton or anything like that. I mean, he was a monk. He was a bit bookish. He might even have been a bit of a geek, actually, reading between the lines. He doesn't seem to have been very capable or worldly wise in some ways. And he seems to have been pretty clumsy, as we shall see. So he maybe wasn't the obvious person to do this incredible, heroic, epic journey. But eventually, it just seems to have dawned on him. It just seems to have come so apparent to him that this is what he's supposed to have been doing, that he decided to do it. He took his courage in both hands and thought, I'm going to go to India. So the first thing he did was ask the Emperor of China for permission. He felt he needed the support of authority. He felt he needed permission from authority to do this. And he doesn't get it. Instead, for political reasons, the emperor forbade him from making the journey. Too difficult to go into the reasons, but there were political reasons why he just didn't want anyone travelling out of China through those countries at that time. He said, no, you must not go. I forbid you to go. So, well, as the emperor, you know, you don't. It's a pretty serious thing to do the journey. It's a pretty serious thing to sort of defy the emperor. So he stops, you know. He thinks, well, can't do it then. Emperor's told me not to, can't do it. So he hangs around. He doesn't want to defy authority. But eventually he keeps getting these dreams and these omens and these intuitions that are really clearly sort of prodding him, saying, go on, go. He knows, he comes to really know that he's got to make this journey and that he'll be unhappy and unfulfilled for the rest of his days if he doesn't. So he defies the emperor. He decides to defy the emperor and makes his way to the northwest border of China and sets out on the journey. So in a way, this is Xuan Zang's going forth, his first going forth, is making this journey. He's already become a monk, which is often sort of regarded as sort of going forth. But actually, for him, that was going forth into a quite respectable role. The real going forth for Xuan Zang is defying authority and leaving his homeland to become the sort of person, become the person that he could be, to do what he's meant to be doing. So Xuan Zang goes forth this first time. He makes the journey to northwest China, intending to disobey the emperor and travel to India. On the way, he gets conned and he gets robbed. He's not all that good at this, actually. So he ends up completely ill-prepared for this journey. He doesn't have a guide. He doesn't have any money. He doesn't have a guide. We're told he has a skinny old horse. That's all he's got. He's a skinny old horse. So thus, singularly unprepared, he makes his way to what's called the Jade Gate, which is the edge of the civilized world, and sets off into the Gobi Desert. A bookish monk without a guide on a skinny old horse setting off into one of the most inhospitable environments on Earth. He describes the Gobi Desert as this place where, you know, the only way you find your way, if you know you're on the right track because of the bones of all the people who died along the way, If you don't see bones, you're in big trouble, because then you're not even on the right track, where the winds just howl and they obliterate all the tracks. You can never see where you're going, and they drive you mad. But he does it. He sets off through the Jade Gate into the Gobi Desert. And as he passes the Jade Gate, he takes a vow. He vows that he would rather die facing India than go back to China without getting there, no matter what happens. So he passes out into the Gobi Desert, and soon he gets caught in a sandstorm. He gets caught in a sandstorm that blows all the tracks away. And he ends up completely lost. He has no idea. You've got to head from oasis to oasis. He has no idea which way the next oasis is. He doesn't know where he is. And then things get even worse. He's sort of settling down for the night one night, completely lost. When he gets the water, there's a sort of water skin off the back of his horse, and he drops it. And he scrabbles around trying to get it. And all of the water goes glug, 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 into the sand. So there he is, he's completely lost. He's got no water. He just thinks, well, I'm going to die. This is it. I've absolutely had my chips. I'm a dead man. Sorry, horse, you're a dead horse. And he actually thinks about going back. He goes back a little bit, but then he remembers his vow. And he turns around and he sort of says, well, I'm going towards India. Yeah, I'll just keep going. That was my vow. So here he is, completely lost, no water, he hasn't got a chance. But somehow it seems as though he's doing what he's meant to be doing, and as though sort of the universe cooperates with him. He gets guidance from Avalokiteshvara, his Yodam. He gets guidance from Avalokiteshvara in dreams and visions. And he gets a lot of help from his skinny old horse as well, who seems to have a nose for water. And somehow, a miracle, he finds the next oasis. He finds the oasis. And somehow, a miracle, he actually makes the whole epic journey. Having got to the first oasis, he makes this whole epic journey right the length of the Gobi Desert to the western end of the Gobi Desert. So this is complete, you know, I mean, for him to have done this is just completely remarkable. And it seems as though it's just his commitment brings resources on stream for him, brings strengths on stream for him. Gives him wisdom that he wouldn't normally have. It's as though his Shraddha, his commitment, gets the universe on his side. And eventually he arrives at the oasis kingdom of Turfan. But he arrives at Turfan as a completely different person to the one who set out into the Gobi Desert. He's grown immensely in the process. He's found his mission in life, if you like. He knows what he's doing. And he's got the solidity and integrity that comes from commitment. He's stuck to his mission in life when it seemed hopeless. And this has somehow allowed him to discover really deep resources in himself, deep strengths in himself, that he didn't even know he had. So he enters the oasis kingdom of Turfan, not as the bookish, rather incapable, clumsy Tuan San who left China. What the people of Turfan see isn't the sort of bookish, slightly geeky monk. They see someone who has a higher forces behind them, if you like, someone who looks more defined and solid than most people, someone who casts a deeper shadow than most people, someone who stands out in a crowd. He's really become an exceptional person by following his mission in life, finding his inner resources. So not surprisingly, this exceptional monk comes to the notice of the king. The king of Turfan is told about this exceptional monk, and he invites him to court, he feasts him, he gets to know him. So the king gets to know him. He becomes his friend. The king really takes a shine to him. So he takes a shine to him, and he wants him to stay. He wants him to stay. This exceptional person has blown up, sort of washed up in his kingdom, and he thinks, I want this man to stay. So he says, stay here, and I'll make you the main spiritual advisor to my court and my kingdom. Don't bother with this, going to India. It's a long way. You won't like the food. It's all hot. it's difficult, you know, stay here, you can do immense good here. I'll make you my main spiritual advisor to my court and my kingdom. You'll have a wealthy, luxurious life. You'll be a powerful man. You'll have really high status. You'll be one of the highest status people in the kingdom. You'll have the respect of the whole kingdom. And, I know you monks are supposed to be renunciants, but between you and me, any pleasure you like will be yours for the asking. You know, we know that we people at the top of the echelons need our little pleasures, you know. So, in a sort of mythic way, Swan Song is presented with the very trap and temptation that we started out talking about. Instead of going to all the risk and discomfort of becoming the person he's meant to be and doing the thing he's meant to do, he can use the Dharma to get what his ego wants, to get all those things we put up there, gain, praise, pleasure and status and power. Instead of using the Dharma to go beyond his worldly ego, he can use the Dharma to get everything his worldly ego wants. To have all of the eight worldly winds, wealth, praise, pleasure, status, power. But, I mean, we wouldn't have heard of Huan Song if he'd said yes. But after risking death in the Gobi Desert, he isn't going to be seduced off course that easily. He isn't going to betray Avalokiteshvara, who's helped him out so much, and his true self and his destiny. He's completely adamant to the king. I'm not going to do that. It's very kind, very generous, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to India to find the true Dharma and bring it back to China. So, kings are used to getting what they want. They're not used to having their favours turned down. Samsara is used to getting what it wants. It's used to us caving in at the merest hint of the eight worldly winds. Not to us sticking to our spiritual guns. And the king's like that. He's used to getting what he wants. So he gets very angry. He gets very angry with Swan Song, turning down his patronage. And he has him locked up. He has him locked up and he says, you're not going India or anywhere, mate. I'm going to keep you there till you come to your senses. Come out, apologise, and I'll make you the spiritual advisor to my kingdom. If you say you're going, you can just stay in jail. To Swan Song, it looks like, he can never get to India now. He's just locked in jail with this nasty king. He's locked him in jail. He's miles away yet, and he's in jail. He's never going to get there. But he sticks to his convictions. That's the sort of commitment he has. He knows what he's got to do, and he sticks to it, even when it seems completely impossible, even when circumstances say, this is completely impossible, be sensible, make some compromises, do something different. He doesn't. He just sticks to it. And for some reason, it turns out not to be as hopeless. Because he sticks to it, it turns out not to have been hopeless after all. So Swan Song does just this. He defies the king. He goes on hunger strike. So he goes on hunger strike. He says, right, I'm not eating. You can let me out or I'll die. I don't care, but I'm not eating. Let me go and let me go to India, but I'm not eating. And he goes on hunger strike and he sends a message to the king saying, I'm going to starve to death unless you let me out. Simple. It's up to you. And in fact, he does starve himself. He gets weak and he gets ill. And some people think he's at death's door. But Tuan Sang's commitment ends up so impressing the king that the king repents. He feels disgusted with himself. He's obviously sort of has this, you know, he just feels, well, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? He feels disgusted with himself. And he sees that Swan Song is a bigger being than he is. He sees that Swan Song knows what he's doing while he himself, the king, is being small and selfish. So he's disgusted with himself. He gets Swan Song out of jail. He dusts him off. He feeds him up. He apologizes profusely to him. And then he offers him every help for his journey that he can muster. So he's just complete turnaround. He just decides, right, I'm ashamed of myself. I'll help this man fulfill his destiny in any way I can. So the king gives him for his journey, for the rest of his journey, gives him 30 horses. He gives him 24 servants and soldiers to help and protect him. So he's the head, now he's the head of a caravan. He's not a lone wanderer. He gives him 100 ounces of gold and sacks full of silver pieces. He gives him 500 rolls of precious silk. So he's got enough wealth. One son reckons he's got enough wealth to last him for 20 years, last him and his caravan for 20 years, and do anything he wants, travel anywhere he wants. The king also gives him 24 letters to 24 other kings, asking them to protect Tuan Sang. So I won't tell the rest of Tuan Sang's story, but just this part illustrates our theme pretty well, that Tuan Sang gained, so he starts out, he gains in stature immensely from his first going forth, from his first spiritual death. He gained a lot of inner resources and inner riches from that. And then in Turfan, when he met the king, he could have settled down and cashed in his merit. He could have cashed in his merit for the 8 worldly winds. He could have cashed in his merit for what his ego wants. So he could have allowed his ego to appropriate the gains that the Dharma had given him. And instead, he's willing to suffer another death. He's literally willing to face death, a real one, by starving himself. And because he was willing to keep, as it were, facing spiritual death, keep on leaving behind his ego motives, because he won't settle down, he just became richer and richer and richer. In fact, he ends up not being a single lonely monk. He ends up being a royal rich caravan traveling to India, which we could say sort of symbolizes the richness that he's gained. He's completely transformed from the rather sad figure who left China. He's now this royal, he's the head of a royal procession with 30 horses, 24 retainers. So that's the story of Tuan Sang, or part of the story of Tuan Sang. And the Buddhist tradition is full of stories that make a similar sort of point, but in a rather different way. So they've got a few things, they've usually got a few things in common, these stories. They usually start with someone who seems to be living a perfectly good, praiseworthy existence. Someone who seems even to be living the spiritual life, but in a way that brings them plenty of side benefits, brings them, it's pretty comfortable, and it brings them some status, etc., some social status. Maybe they're even famous as scholars or as practitioners. So that's one thing they have in common. The person concerned seems to be living a perfectly decent, perfectly good spiritual life. And is probably getting plenty of praise for doing so. That's the first thing. The second thing they have in common is that something from outside, as it were, sort of erupts into the comfortable life of the hero or heroine. Something, as it were, from a different dimension or a different level of being. So maybe the hero or heroine gets a visit from somebody who, you might say, sort of represents their higher self or represents their destiny or represents the higher forces that are trying to act through them. So the hero or heroine might see this visitor from a different realm. They might see this person as a beautiful bodhisattva. Or they might see them as an ugly, scary figure they don't want to know. Depending on how they view, how open they are to the death of the person they are at the moment, the spiritual death and rebirth. So they've all got a cozy life, then something, a visitor from outside, a visitor from another realm comes. And then the third thing they've got in common is that the visitor tells or advises them to do something that any sensible person, operating according to the 8 worldly winds, or any sensible person operating towards to conventional wisdom, wouldn't do. Just look completely stupid and nonsensical. Nobody would do it. From a worldly point of view, it's daft. And then the fourth thing they've got in common is that they do it. They do it anyway. They follow the advice. They follow the advice. And the fifth thing they've all got in common is that doing this, following this completely mad advice, has really far-reaching positive consequences, both for the person concerned and for the world in general. Although it looked like the most stupid thing to do, from the ego's point of view, it was the right thing to do from the point of view, if you like, of the higher self or of the true self or their potential or the universe, if you like. So a couple of weeks ago, we sort of heard a rather abbreviated version of one such story in which Vajratara made an appearance as a Dakini. I don't know if anyone's here. So we heard a little abbreviated version of this story. And it's the story of Naropa. So Naropa was born into an aristocratic family in India in about 1016 of the Christian era. And he, in his youth, he was forced into an arranged marriage, which he really didn't want. And he escaped from his arranged marriage, from the bonds of the household life, as he saw it, by becoming a monk. He took ordination as a monk, a Buddhist monk. And as a young monk, he devoted himself really intensely to study and practice. He was the model student. He was the model student. And by his early 30s, he actually acquired such fame for his intellectual prowess that he was actually rose to the position of abbot of the great monastic university at Nalanda by the age of 30. It's a bit like being vice chancellor of Cambridge or something at 30. It's like mega position. Nalanda University is sometimes said at the time to have been the largest and greatest university on earth at the time. I don't know whether that's true. It was certainly the largest and most prestigious Buddhist university in India. So at 30, he's abbot of Nalanda. And during the 8 years that he was abbot of Nalanda, he achieved widespread fame as one of India's foremost Buddhist scholars. So what's wrong with that? Nothing. I mean, this is wonderful, isn't it? He was studying, he was practicing, he was helping others. But he was also in a position where it was very easy for the Dharma to stop being a way of going beyond the ego and the eight worldly winds, and for the Dharma to become a way for the ego to satisfy its desires for things like praise and status. And maybe this is what was happening. I don't know. Because after a while, Naropa received a not very welcome visitation. So one day he was reading in his study, when he becomes aware there's somebody standing looking at him. And he looked up and he saw this ugly, really ugly old woman, this old hag. And she pointed a stick at him and said, "You! Do you understand what you're reading?" And he says, "Yeah, I understand what I'm reading." And she starts capering around madly, sort of cackling and chortling. And then she points the stick at him again and says, "Do you understand the essence of what you're reading?" And he says, "Yeah." And she bursts into tears. She's sobbing uncontrollably. And he says, "What's wrong? You know, why are you crying 1 minute and you're burst into tears the next?" She says, "Well, I was laughing because I was happy because you told the truth, because you do understand the words of what you're reading. You do understand what you're reading intellectually. But then I was sobbing because you lied to me and you lied to yourself. You understand what you're reading at the intellectual level, but you don't have a clue of what's really behind those words. You don't have the experience they're based on. You understand the concepts and the words, but that's all. You don't have any real realization, and you're never going to, leading the cozy life you live. Pretending to be the big whiz in Buddhist studies is never going to get you there. So get yourself out of here and find a real teacher. You're supposed to be a teacher. Find yourself a real one. Go and live in the jungle and find Tilopa." Never heard of Tilopa. It's said that this old woman was in fact a Dakini. She was actually on a mission from the transcendental to give Naropa a push, or maybe she was a manifestation of his higher self giving him a push. But whatever she was, her visit completely rocked him. He thought about it and he realized, he admitted to himself, that his understanding of the Dharma was just intellectual. He saw that he needed to deepen it. And maybe he also admitted to himself that his very respectable, very comfortable position wasn't helping him to go beyond his ego. There was no way this was going to help to go beyond his ego. In fact, it was just more food for his ego. So he took an enormous step. He underwent an enormous spiritual death. He gave up his comfortable, prestigious position as head of the largest and most prestigious Buddhist university in India. And he wandered off in the jungle to look for somebody called Tilopa, who neither he nor anyone else had ever heard of. Whoever he was. It was a completely mad thing to do for any sensible person. I think most of us would have found a million rationalizations why it was better to stay at Narada. Yes, she's all right. I'll take on board what she said. I need to do things a bit differently. I'll learn the lesson, but there's no need to be too sudden or foolhardy about this. I think this would be what most of us would do. But he didn't do that. He stepped out into the unknown. He took the old woman's advice. He went off on this fool's errand to look for Tilopa. He went through a spiritual death. The old, perfectly good, but perhaps rather stuck Naropa died. He killed him off to make way for something better. Although he couldn't have any security about that something better. So he wandered. He wandered in the jungle. He wandered it for a long time. Lots of adventures happened to him. But like Tuan Sang, he had a load of shraddha. He had a load of sort of faith, a lot of determination. And he eventually found this Tilopa. He eventually found someone called Tilopa. But for a respectable Buddhist scholar and a high-ranking, respectable academic, Tilopa probably didn't seem like a very likely teacher. Tilopa was anything but respectable. In fact, Tilopa seemed a bit of a wide boy and veered between being a wide boy and being a tramp, really. He wasn't a respectable figure at all. He was anything but conventional. He was anything but high status. He certainly wasn't a prestigious monk, with all the respect that that brings. He was just this guy who practiced the Dharma. He was not even apparently a conventional good man or holy man at all. In fact, it's said that sometimes he begged for his living, but it's also said that at one time he ran a house of ill repute, rather politely put, to support himself. And then I think at the time that Naropa found him, he got his name Tilopa, which means sesame seed, because he, for a long time, he made his living by grinding sesame seeds to make oil by hand, which probably isn't the most highly paid job in the world, which he apparently saw, he took as a metaphor. This laborious grinding was a metaphor for extracting the essence of enlightenment from the dross of life. So he would grind sesame seeds for the oil. So he's not a very likely teacher, and nor was he an easy teacher. He wasn't an easy teacher. He put Naropa through all sorts of tests. He subjected him to all sorts of hardships to tame his proud ego. And I mean, this must have been incredibly difficult for this high-status, prestige scholar, Naropa. A bit like a prestigious Oxbridge professor and media personality putting up with being humbled by an old tramp who says that he's got something to teach. But Naropa stuck with it. He stuck with it. He realized this guy had got something. And he stuck with it. He, in fact, studied with him for 12 years. He went through an intense 12-year training with Tilopa, during which he was put through all sorts of things. He was put through all sorts of things to test and to try him and to get him out of his ruts. The feats of devotion and commitment he went through, in fact, became legendary in later tradition. And eventually, at the end of 12 years, we're told he broke through. He had a complete breakthrough. And he became Tilopa's. Tilopa adopted him as his foremost disciple and the lineage holder, the person who carried on his lineage, the lineage of his teaching. He formulated Tilopa's teachings as what came to be called the Six Yogas of Naropa, which became the basis of masses of Tibetan tantric practice. Naropa studied under Tilopa. He then became, in turn, this chap from Tibet wandered down. This farmer from Tibet wandered down to India, the forests of India, looking for a teacher. This chap called Marpa And Marpa discovered Naropa and sat at Naropa's feet and went through from Naropa what Naropa had gone through from Tilopa. And Marpa went back to Tibet. And then Marpa met up with somebody called Milarepa, who you may have heard of. He became Milarepa's teacher. And Milarepa had a student subsequently called Gampopa, who started the Kagyu tradition in Tibet, which became one of the most important and spiritually vibrant traditions in Tibetan Buddhism. If you travel to Scotland, in the lowlands of Scotland, you can go to a Kagyu temple and monastery. They're all over the world now. They're in America. They're all over the world. If you've ever come across a teacher called Chogyam Trungpa, well, he's of that tradition. So, you know, the impact actually that Naropa had, you can feel here and now. It's here and now. It was enormous in Tibet, and it's now worldwide from something that happened all those years ago. His spiritual death, his decision to leave Nalanda and go and study with this completely unlikely teacher, had the most terrific echoes, the most terrific impact on Tibetan Buddhism and on Buddhism throughout the world, if you like. So that's a second story. It illustrates, I think, the same thing. So I'd like to round off just by saying, well, often we think that circumstances determine what we can do and what we can't do in our life. We often think that circumstances determine what we can't do. We think, well, I'd like to do that, but I couldn't possibly. It's impossible. My circumstances make it impossible. But you might notice that Xuan Sang and various other people that we've talked about, Xuan Sang and Naropa, didn't do that. Naropa might have thought, well, yes, it would be nice to go off and find some tantric teacher, but, I've got responsibilities. I'm head of Nalanda. Xuan Sang might have said, well, I can't do that. I've been banned from doing it by the emperor. You know, I mean, circumstances mean it would be, I know I feel I should, but I can't do it. So we let that happen. Any sensible person perhaps would say, I can't do that because. But these people didn't do that, did they? They didn't do that. They sort of went through mega changes. They didn't let circumstances dictate to them.